This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, this is Kylie Pentelow, and you're listening to the Woman's Hour podcast.
Welcome to Weekend Woman's Hour with me, Kylie Pentelow. On today's programme, actor, comedian and author Miranda Hart on the restorative powers of walking and the outdoors. Plus, how to parent your children when they're adults. They've already moved on to a life independent from you. The question is, have you? We'll talk through that tricky shift from being the main event to a supporting actor in their lives with psychotherapist Dr. Julia Samuel and actor Helen Lederer. Also, the women hoping to break two records rowing across the Atlantic. One will be the oldest, the other, the first person with cystic fibrosis to row any ocean. We'll find out how tough the challenge will be, and those all-important questions about how to take discreet comfort breaks on a 10-metre rowing boat. And if that's not enough, we've got the music of Dolly Parton, the subject of a new musical with its star Trisha Paluccio as Dolly. All that to come, but first, you'll have likely heard yesterday about the government's plan to shake up adult social care. The Secretary of State for Health and Social Care, Wes Streeting, has promised a new national care service with increased funding and an independent commission headed up by crossbench peer Baroness Louise Casey. Adult social care is a predominantly female workforce. Women make up more than 80% of staff working in this sector. They also make up the majority of people carrying out unpaid caring responsibilities. 10% of women and girls in England and Wales provide unpaid care. That's nearly 3 million in total. So what impact could these changes have on them and the many people who rely on adult social care, either themselves or for a relative? Well, to discuss this, I was joined by Melanie Williams, Director of Adult Social Care in Nottinghamshire and also President of the Association of Directors of Adult Social Services, and Helen Walker, Chief Executive of Carers UK, a national charity supporting unpaid carers. And I began by asking Melanie, what was her reaction to this news?
You're quite right to note that this is a particular issue for us women. So my immediate reaction is the time scale. So Secretary of State did call me yesterday and I was really pleased to hear him give commitment to interim report findings in a year. But for me, it's what is the scope of those findings? Because quite honestly, we were promised a 10-year plan to run alongside in parallel. It's really important. It's in parallel to the NHS plan. But that work has already started. So the NHS is really gaining momentum about the changes they want to achieve. So I'm really interested to know, is the commission a part of that plan or is the commission the plan? And we'll have to wait the 3 years for the plan. And then ultimately, some people may not experience some change to the quality of their life for 14 years. So that's my immediate reaction.
Well, Streeting has said that public services are on their knees. He's acknowledged that. He said that so much more needs to be done, but that the process would take time. So do you acknowledge that this kind of long-term plan needs to be put in place, that time needs to be taken to get a system that actually lasts?
I think there are a number of elements to reform that we can get on with without needing that long-term plan. So I'm sure Helen will touch on this, but a carer strategy, a cross-government carer strategy that we heard about at the Labour Party conference will be one of those areas of reform and tackling unpaid care. We can do much about our workforce strategy. So you mentioned wanting to hear from care workers. There's a lot we can do. And the sector united actually in the summer to develop a draft workforce strategy to talk about the things that don't require investment, but the areas that require some investment that could really change the experience of the care workers, how we support them, how we just support development and how we sustain the recruitment and retention of this important workforce. And then not least, some of the models of social care support. There's lots of evidence out there from people with lived experience about what can make a difference to their lives now. But certainly things like paying for care, they're really knotty issues that have undermined reform in the last 30 years. To me, that is ripe for somebody like Louise Casey leading a commission that's intended to implement. So this resulting in a bill that delivers some change, I think, is the right approach. But there's so much more we could be doing now to tackle the quality of people's lives.
There are some shorter term measures that the government are putting in place, £86 million to boost the Disabled Facilities Grant this year. That's a grant to help people adapt their homes, isn't it, for their needs. Will that help?
to me, that sort of feels a little bit like a tiny sticking plaster. So that would impact on probably around 2,000 adaptations for people. So that's quite a small amount. So if you think of just Nottinghamshire, so I support 13,000 people with long-term care needs, about 20,000 people we have contact with in a typical year. So that's quite a small amount of people. What it doesn't do is tackle the impact of the National Insurance contributions, the blended living wage package, and some of the complexity of need. We know that people need more care now than they did 3 years ago. So it kind of doesn't cover those costs of care in the shorter term.
Can we just briefly go back to basics? And can you explain who adult social care is actually for?
Yeah, so adult social care is about supporting people to live a good life in a place they call home. If we think about the just short of a million people that draw upon adult social care support, they're kind of in two groups. So one group is working age adults. So it might be somebody of my age. I may need support 24 hours a day, or I may need just a little bit of support with a bit of prompting and supporting some of my daily living. The other group of people that we support are people who are older, and some of those people have some health needs. There are many people that have social care support where really what they're needing is about their social life. So it's quite distinct from healthcare, and it works in a whole range of ways. So we provide support to people maybe who are detained in mental health hospitals or in prison. We support people who are living in their own home. It's like a range of settings and a range of things that we do to support people to enjoy that good life I mentioned.
And who pays for it?
That's a really good question. So it will really depend on the individual, which is what really complicates us thinking about what the long-term plan would look like and how we tackle some of these issues. So for example, if I'm in my early 50s, so if I have a mental health difficulty, a lifelong mental health difficulty, and I need support from somebody to help me manage my day-to-day living, to prompt me to get up and to find work and do the things that are important to me, I would make a small contribution to my care. So even if I received welfare benefits, I would make a contribution to that from my own income. It's very likely that my care would be funded by the council. So the council tax would be a contribution. But if I had my parents who were older, it may be that my parents had some health needs as they were aging. Some may not. And they, again, would be funding their own care and doing that quite independently. So there may be an element of NHS funding that somebody receives. But again, mainly the person would be making a contribution to their care. And if they're a younger person, again, it would be the same thing. So maybe I have a learning disability, I need quite a high degree of support, I'm paying for my social care. That may be alongside other things like housing support or DWP support. There may be a whole range of things that someone's accessing.
As we've been saying, the vast majority of care workers are women. From people that we've heard anecdotally, I've got a family member who is a care worker, tough and quite low paid job, I think it's fair to say. Why do you think it is that more women do it, and how can they be supported in your view?
I think part of womanhood is part of caring. So I was drawn to care. I did care work in my early career, some 30 years ago, and I really felt like I wanted to give back. And I think many women feel that they want to be supporting others. So I think it's a profession that we're attracted to. It's also become a low pay workforce over time. So when I started 30 years ago, I was paid more than the national living wage. I think over time, as we've reduced our investment into adult social care and it's competed with other public services, we've paid people less and less because of those reductions. So it's become, unfortunately, a low pay workforce.
Let's bring in Helen Walker, Chief Executive of Carers UK. Helen, the Carers UK is a national charity, as we said, supporting unpaid carers. There are 4.7 million unpaid carers in England, 3 million of which are women. So this leads on from what we were just talking about. So how do you think these proposals that we've been hearing about could affect them?
Well, I mean, it's very difficult to say, isn't it? I think we have to welcome the fact that this government are looking to reform social care long term and looking to have cross-party consensus so we actually get the reform that that we need. I think the issue, though, as Melanie has already said, is the timelines. So the short term is where we see there isn't sufficient funding, there are massive problems for social care, and we need to make sure that in the spending review, there's enough money to prevent further cuts in social care and to keep it going, if you like. Because at the moment, unpaid carers are picking up the slack. And I think that's the big anxiety, is that, you know, unpaid carers, you know, we've gone through COVID where social care in many places shut down. They haven't had respite breaks. They've gone into the cost of living crisis. And now suddenly they're continuing to prop up a crumbling health and social care system. And at some point, they themselves will break if they don't get adequate respite. Many carers say that they just can't cope anymore. They're not getting adequate support. They're not getting adequate respite breaks. So I think there needs to be some short-term solutions, and as Melanie said, a national carer strategy to get cross-government support for unpaid carers, to recognise that they are everywhere and they need support in a variety of different ways. That's something that could be done in the short term whilst Baroness Casey is undertaking this review.
And what do you think of the fact that she's undertaking the review? Do you feel optimistic with her at the head of it?
Yes, I do feel optimistic. I think she's done some really good work in the past. I think that she's a cross-party peer, so that there is a greater chance of having a cross-party consensus on the outcome of this review. And so instead of it failing at that final hurdle, as it has so consistently done, that we've got a fighting chance of actually getting a sensible solution for social care, which will help unpaid carers in the longer term. But my anxiety, as with many of our colleagues in social care, is that we need some short-term investment. You know, we've got this big issue with the national insurance increase and the increase in national living wage, which has a particular impact on social care because it is so low paid. So we need to make sure that there's adequate funding in the short term to prevent any further crumbling of that social care service.
That was Melanie Williams and Helen Walker there. Well, we approached the Department of Health and Social Care, who directed us to Wes Streeting's statements. He said, "We are appointing one of our country's leading public service reformers and Whitehall's greatest doer to finally grasp the nettle on social care reform." We also asked you for your views and experiences of social care, and here are some of them. Brenda says, "None of your guests mention the elephant in the room. Many get no financial help whatsoever as they have savings in excess of £23,500. However, the cost caring companies charge can be from £20 to £40 an hour. Care home costs also vary." She goes on to say, "My husband's care for the final 10 months of his life was just over £1,200 a week. Savings often do not last long." And this one here from Paul. Paul says, "I cared for my mother at our home in Essex for over 9 years through her dementia illness. I believe that only a national care service that's free at the point of need, like the NHS, will provide a fair ongoing solution to the care crisis. Thank you very much for all your comments." Now, we had a very special Women's Hour programme on New Year's Day, all about walking. If you missed it, don't worry, you can listen back on BBC Sounds. Nuala looked at what really happens to our bodies and our minds when we go out for a stomp. She also heard from women who find inspiration from walking. And she was joined by the comedian and author Miranda Hart, whose love of walking became even stronger after she was unable to go out for a walk for a prolonged period of time due to illness. And Nuala began by asking Miranda how important nature has been through her life.
Yes, I've always loved the great outdoors. It's the most wonderful playground, isn't it? And I love space and solitude and quiet, and often prefer animals to people as an introvert, you know, all that. But the fascinating sort of discovery I went on was that when I became ill and was bedbound and housebound on and off for many years, suddenly my beautiful playground that brought me peace and regulation and excitement was no longer there. So I now have an even deeper respect for it and love for it because I lost it for a few years. So it's been a really interesting experience.
And maybe we could take a moment just to talk about that, because I saw you have described dealing with your fatigue as almost being in lockdown for years. And yes, in lockdown, which many of us went through, we were able to get snippets of nature. Many people talked about nature kind of keeping them sane. But I can't imagine what it must have been like to physically not be able to go and immerse yourself in a way that you had previously.
Yeah, it was really tough. And also it's that feeling just missing movement generally as well. So what I often did was imagine myself moving, and I felt the effect on my body sort of a little light in that. And there's some extraordinary science and research upon the effect of visualizing movement helping the body, but that's not really my area. But I then found myself going, right, I'm really missing that connection. I'm really missing the sense of movement, because even if you're still in nature, it's moving. You know, the grasses are, the streams are moving, the grasses are blowing in the wind. It's just that sense of, I'm going to be okay, everything's progressing, and gently rather than in the pace of our modern nature. So I started just looking out of the window and just kind of connecting with nature in a very different way. So the tree outside my window on and off years became my friend, which might sound rather trite, but it was seeing this, having respect for this amazing, living, growing, moving thing, and seeing it through the seasons and realising I was a part of that.
You know, I'm often surprised by seasons. I mean, it gets me every year, you know, when the trees turn, for example, in September or October, or when buds begin in spring. I can totally understand you having that connection, particularly if it is your window, I suppose, onto a life that you want to get to.
And also, what I really learned from it was, you know, often when I was well and fit and healthy and just, I suppose, took that movement for granted or the ability to get out and about, often in February I was like, oh, come on, spring. You know, we sort of moan in January, don't we? And that sort of pace, I think, that often modern life has got us into, I was suddenly like, gosh, when you just have a window to stare at, you realise how slow it is, but how right that is. You know, and the winter for me now has become a time where I allow myself to go fallow as well, you know, and I think I can sort of trust the process, rest more, trust that things will be okay, that actually the slower pace is better for me. So I learned a lot from that as well, just being more present and still rather than trying to rush nature.
And that is something that I found fascinating with you, that it was kind of when you reached a level of acceptance, which you're talking there in a way about nature as well, kind of respecting it'll take as long as it takes, that was almost when you began to turn a corner. And I want to speak about a butterfly that was in your room that you detail in your book. Can you tell can you tell our listeners about that?
One morning I wasn't fully bedbound at that point. I went downstairs to my parents' house where I was spending lockdown. And I heard this fluttering against a window. And I saw this butterfly frantically sort of, you know, against the window trying to get out. And I got it on the edge of a book and took it to an open window. And it just sort of sat on the windowsill, kind of almost like getting its breath and its wings sort of slowing down. And the metaphor was easy for me to see there, that I really felt when I heard and saw the butterfly flapping against the window, I thought, that's how I feel internally. I'm still so angry that I'm unwell. I'm still so angry I can't go for those big stomps. I'm just wanting to get out there. And actually then this butterfly showed me by, you know, its natural process, just take a breath. This is where you are now. What is the point of fighting against it? It's just going to be exhausting. And so I had this beautiful moment with this butterfly who eventually then just flew off and gave me this beautiful lesson and an acceptance, which, can I just say, is still blooming hard every day.
But you did start those steps to getting better. And I'll move from butterflies to bluebells.
It was really walking and getting out of my mum's garden and just taking very small steps, literally and metaphorically, that really did help my fatigue-based illness. But maybe 6 months after I'd first started walking, I went the first place I'd been in Cornwall for a long time, so outside my own house. And it was like being in a film. And I wasn't expecting bluebells. I was walking on this little path and I saw a clump of little bluebells. And I thought, oh my gosh, am I going to come across a carpeted woodland? And I did. And I just sat down and couldn't stop crying. Not only, I think it was the initial beauty of those bluebells, but because I'd imagined them and never thought maybe I'd never see them again, it then also made me think about what I'd been through. So I was crying on many levels, grief there as well. But yeah, I will never take for granted seeing something as exquisitely beautiful and simple as a bluebell ever again.
And if I were to ask you how you think those first steps in your mum's garden, for example, or nature helped you heal, and obviously, it's not the same for everyone. This is your personal experience. What would you say it was?
I would say it was a sort of mind-body connection of me trusting my body again, that it did have some energy in it. Because with fatigue-based illnesses, you do lose a lot of your energy cells. And, you know, ME is a very real physical condition, not a behavioural one. And then you lose a lot of trust in your body, thinking, how much have I got? Will I do too much? And all that sort of thing. So it was literally sort of, we'll do 10 paces and working with my body and it telling me when I'm pushing it. And I would do things, I'm doing it now with my hands. I'm just sort of like a conductor. I'm just sort of, we'll just move my limbs about even when I was sitting up in bed. And I could feel my body and energy coming back.
I'm just thinking back to something you said a few minutes ago. You know, when you talked about you would imagine yourself moving before you were able to. What did you imagine then?
Oh, well, I had great fun daydreaming about, I was like, well, I read about visualization.
Yes, yes. I've read about this too. There's even studies that basically, if you imagine yourself practicing the piano, it can be as helpful sometimes as actually practicing the piano. Yeah. That's the one I remember.
Yeah. And you start going, you know, when you're particularly when you're ill, you're like, oh, really? Please. You know, it's very hard to believe. Then you read these studies of particularly with illnesses. I mean, I read the research on fatigue-based illnesses of the brain telling the body. I mean, it's just fascinating that it's safe to move. And it does help repair some cells, apparently. So I was told, you know, start visualizing. And I was very resistant to start with because I was like, how's this going to help? You know? And I thought, well, I might as well. I'm just lying here. And instead of being in a negative loop of thought pattern, I might as well go on flights of fantasy and daydream. So, I walked up mountains and I was just, you just sort of speak out loud and imagine it and imagine the freedom in your body. And you sort of talk to yourself and say, I've got strength now going up this mountain. I feel powerful and strong. I won Olympic gold at rowing once.
Oh, well done, Miranda.
Thank you very much. Yeah. I think I was pogo sticking. And I did actually genuinely, I committed to doing it for a bit, almost like to kind of as a skeptic going, is this going to really work? And I have to say it did.
But I want to talk about play. You mentioned the outdoors being a playground. I was struck by that word. And there is a whole chapter where you talk about play and having adventures. And there's one chapter, and I'll read a little of what you wrote. We have been duped yet again into thinking that there is no time to catch a falling leaf, watch a sunset, nap under the shade of a tree, dangle our feet in a river. How poorer we are for it. We've spoken very much about the physical. If you're okay speaking a little bit about the mental impact or transformation that you have had, being able to do some of the things that you weren't able to do before.
Yeah, I think finding that sense of play actually in nature, just little things like walking barefoot on the grass. I'm smiling now just thinking about it. And that smile, you know, calms your nervous system, which calms your immune system, which the immune system is my big problem. Just that smile, just the sense of awe and wonder as well. And also I walk slower. The blessing in hefty disguise of fatigue is I've had to walk slower. And so I look up more and I look around, and it's the slower pace that really calms my mind. I have a very busy mind.
Are you kind of watching yourself now to make sure you don't fall back into old habits, for example? And is there perhaps a favourite walk that helps you stay on the straight and narrow, even on a curved path?
I love it. I think every day I have to, my book, I kind of have these 10 treasures, as I call them. And I do have to, pun intended, walk them, you know, every day and keep an eye on myself. It's very easy to go back into old patterns. And there isn't a particular walk at the moment. I'm still having to manage fatigue. So I'm still not able to go on a big sort of cardio power walk or anything like that. So it's just 20 minute, very slow walks around a field. And I find something new in it every day.
That was Miranda Hart there speaking to Nuala for our New Year's Day programme all about walking. And you can hear the whole programme by going to BBC Sounds and searching for Woman's Hour for Wednesday, the 1st of January. Now, being a parent to adult children can be complicated, as can being the adult child. It's something psychotherapist Dr. Julia Samuel often writes about.
So what are the challenges of parenting your adult children who've moved away from home and are living their own lives? What's the best way to go about it? Well, Julia joined Claire McDonnell along with the actor and author Helen Lederer, both of whom have adult children. She began by asking Julia how you define an adult child.
I think there are kind of phases. There's like 18 to 25, 25 to 35. So I think it goes in decades. It isn't when you're legally adult, because I think young people mature much later than, say, my generation did. So I think there's a whole way of parenting children from 18 to 25 to when they then kind of more moving into their lives, forming strong attachments and having their own children.
So the period up to 25, they still look to you a little bit more and you can still have that traditional parental role. Is that what you're saying?
I think you have to kind of reconfigure it, because you will have less control and less power. So I think all of life we need to understand our sort of necessary losses of how we can kind of move in and connect and support, and when we have to stand back and let go, you know, giving children roots and wings. But I think the level of it changes as they change in age.
Helen, that's an interesting phrase, isn't it? Necessary losses. How old is your daughter?
She's 34 currently, yes. The thing about letting go is quite an interesting one. I don't think you ever let a child go in a voluntary sort of manner, but you have to slightly fake it. I'm learning how to not say things. I think maybe that's my new thing for the 2025, to just not say things. That would be a good thing, wouldn't
yes.
it? I'm sure Julia would counsel me that that's a good thing.
You're a great actress, so yes. I mean, you don't
not
give
that
away.
Good. Not that good, because, of course, the thing about the mother and child, I think, is that you press each other's buttons and know each other so well, so that even though you cannot speak, the dynamic of the relationship is going to be acted out.
Your daughter doesn't live in this country anymore.
No, so she lives in Ibiza, and so I've had to get used to it. I don't feel like a typical parent, if there is such a thing, in that there are colleagues of mine whose child lives locally and they might have children by now, and so there's a whole community that's kind of replicated in some way. So I don't feel the acting out option, but lots of WhatsApps and visits and things. So and maybe that is more normal now, about how young people, you know, move away and do more things. Try not to take it as a rejection. Obviously, Claire.
She has left the country.
I suffer.
She has left the country.
Yes.
Julia, so where should we begin with this then? So when they move into this adult phase and, you know, you're still so emotionally connected, but in a way, I suppose the hardest thing, and I felt this when my children, my eldest is 21, and they start to have relationships, and it's almost like being chucked, isn't it? It's like, you know, but hang on, what about me? Is that the big one, that you have to kind of get over that their emotional connection, their first and foremost emotional connection, may lie elsewhere now?
Completely. I mean, as Helen said, that we never let go, that our love for them is as strong as when they were 5, as when they were 15. And that deepens and grows, I think, over time. But it's learning how to love them. I mean, I was still telling my 25-year-old daughter to wear a coat when she went out in the weather, and she's kind of turned on me and said, "Mom, I'm 25. I don't need to be told to wear a coat." And this year at Christmas, all my children are married now, and they have young children. And I could really feel, you know, so much love and pride in seeing them with their kids. But also, I was in the background. I was kind of observing while they were looking after their young babies, and, you know, they were screaming or laughing or whatever it was. But I was very much not the focus. And I think it's learning how to love and feel that deep love. And it is also, as you say, it's a bit like being chucked. You have to kind of deal with the pain of it. And I think learning, you know, pain is the agent of change. And if we can be a parent who can allow ourselves to feel that sense of, I'm really not the center of their lives anymore. You know, I am not the mothership. They don't turn to me. They turn to their partners. They turn to their kids. They turn to their peers. I mean, they may well turn to me at times, but not to feel hurt, and then not to act out on the hurt, I think really matters.
I love Julia's advice. Can I just say, this is great. But what happens when you get, when we are imperfect as humans, and I mean, I still mourn the loss of my daughter's first boyfriend, who I loved. And I was most distraught when that ended. But that was like many years ago. But the chucking thing, everything you say makes such sense. But the actual acting out of it. And are young people more dependent or less dependent? I mean, I talked to my mother about anything and everything, but she must have been alarmed probably at the things I did, looking back. But I haven't stopped my child. I mean, have either of you said, actually, don't do that? I don't experience myself as saying, do not do that.
Yeah.
She makes choices, and the choices are hers.
So your question to Julia is, the bits you find tricky is you say nothing. Julia, is that the right thing to do? Because you must be like a Vesuvius there, Helen, bottling it all up.
Burning.
How did you wade through?
We've just had Christmas, you know.
Yeah. So what would be your advice on that one?
Well, I think if you're really worried about something, it's more collaborative. So it's not like telling them what to do. It's, you know, I see you're with this person or doing this job, and actually I can see you're really unhappy. What's going on? So you can kind of own it and ask questions and be, although actually one of my children hates me asking questions. Mm. So with him, I don't ask questions. So you have to kind of tune yourself to meet the child. But also I think, you know, we have impossible dreams and impossible expectations for our children, and they're often about the disappointments in our own lives. So I think some of it is doing the work on ourselves about what is us and what is them, but also to look at what are the fault lines that we've carried from our parents that we played out with our children that are going to play out again, that we need to try and repair some of those mistakes.
That's such a lot of work, Julia, if I may interrupt. I mean, I love what you're saying. And I do notice that a lot of young people have had therapy, and maybe the modern generation don't hold back. They're quite bold in their critique of us in a way that I probably wouldn't have mentioned to my parents. None of us are perfect, so we know that. Every human being is going to make mistakes as a parent. So that's a given. And we also have to live our own lives. And so that's quite a busy life to kind of therapize myself, therapize how I suffered at the hands of my own parents' weakness, and how not to do that or to do it in a different way.
There is a lot of work, and I think that's a really good point, actually. There's a boldness, isn't there, in this generation, whereas previously we may not have had those conversations with our own parents, still not to this day. So there's a certain, you feel slightly affronted.
Well, the younger generation, I know a lot of young people through my work, so I'm lucky. But then when you meet the partner of your child, that's a different relationship again, because they haven't chosen you to be a friend. So I have to get my head around that. And there is a boldness and a new way of communicating that I think I have to catch up on.
So let's put that question then back. What can you do when you feel uncomfortable about the way you're being spoken to, either by your adult child or their partner? How do you navigate that one?
I mean, I think love is work. Life is work. And, you know, if you think how much we love our children, it's probably worth the effort if we put the time aside.
Yes.
And I think the big thing, rather than communicating, is becoming a really good listener. So, you know, I think we always on transmit as parents, but actually if we really listen and try and reflect back what we've understood, then you can build bridges of connection. The way you can then have many differences and be, as Winnicott said, a good enough parent. We're never, no families are perfect. We're all imperfect. So I'm not talking about this kind of cookie cutter perfect parent. I, you know, my children never stopped taking the piss out of me, all the terrible things I did. And actually, you know, they do skits about it. So it's being able to navigate the difficulties and also the breaking of understanding so that you can repair and reconnect.
That was Julia Samuel and Helen Lederer there. Still to come on the programme, we'll hear the music of Dolly Parton, the subject of a new musical with its star Trisha Paluccio. And remember that you can enjoy Women's Hour any hour of the day. If you can't join us live at 10 a.m. during the week, just subscribe to the daily podcast for free via BBC Sounds. Now, a team of four women from Wales are kickstarting their new year with a record-breaking rowing challenge that's been 3 years in the planning. Sophie, Janine, Maya and Polly are friends from the Nayland Rowing Club in Pembrokeshire, and they're about to spend 60 days together in a 10-metre-long ocean rowing boat to cross the Atlantic.
They're going to row 3,200 miles unaided from Lanzarote to Antigua and are set to break two world records along the way. 32-year-old Sophie will be the first person with cystic fibrosis to row any ocean, and 70-year-old Janine will be the oldest woman to complete this challenge. She's hoping to set a Guinness World Record. Well, I was joined by Sophie and Janine earlier this week, and I began by asking Sophie how the idea for this challenge all came about.
So about 3 years ago, we were at our local rowing club and Janine asked me one day if I'd ever thought about rowing across the Atlantic. And my response to her was, "Are you asking me to row across the Atlantic with you?" And she said, "Yes, I think I am." And that was the start of that.
Brilliant. Tell me how it's all been, like from that point to this point, and are you feeling ready to go?
Well, I think it's been a bit of a crazy journey the past 3 years in itself. And we knew when we decided to take on this challenge that getting to the start line, from when we've spoken to other ocean rowers, they've all told us that often getting to the start line is actually the hardest part, because you're trying to do so many different things, like raising the money to be able to go, turning ourselves into ocean rowers, getting ourselves physically fit. But also, you know, we're doing this alongside you know, our normal lives and working, you know. So it's sort of like, I sort of see it as, it's like having another part-time job on top of, you know, my already full-time job. So it's been really exciting and we've learned so much. And I think that we could probably all say that we're not the same people now that we were when we first signed up to the challenge. You know, it's been really testing at times, but we've worked amazingly well together as a team, and we've all been willing to sort of go on that sort of journey, really. And I think we're all ready to go in terms of, you know, we've spent 3 years talking about doing it, so now it's time to actually do it. But I think there's also definitely, you know, when are you ever ready to go and get in a 10-metre long boat for 60 days?
I can't imagine ever being ready. Janine, when you first approached Sophie and said about this, did you realise that you could potentially be record-breaking and be the oldest woman to complete this challenge?
No, I didn't. I hadn't really thought about that. I just wanted to do it. And then it was incidental. I happened to be going to be the oldest woman at 70. I think the oldest woman at the moment is 64.
Are there any concerns for you over that?
I think for me, I'm very fit. I'm very active. And I always have been. I've been a sea rower for over 30 years. I think the extra bits for me to be careful of is making sure that I eat enough, because, you know, getting older, as you get older, you lose muscle. So if my body is metabolizing muscle instead of fat, I'm never going to put that back on. Mm. So the older I get, the more recovery time I need. So I'll have to be very careful of that. And also, I'm probably more likely to break bones. That's just standard for older people, I think.
Well, gosh, we really wish you the best and hope that doesn't happen. And so, Sophie, you've got some challenges of your own, haven't you? You're going to be managing your cystic fibrosis. So what do you need, and how do you need medication? Like, talk me through what extra facilities you're going to need on the boat.
Yeah, so there are a few different things I'm going to need when I'm out there. So I take quite a few tablets every day. So obviously I still need to be able to take my medication while I'm out there. I also do daily nebulizer treatment to help clear my lungs of any mucus that is there. So for the medication, I'm going to need a fridge. One of my medications has to be kept in the fridge. And so that's not normal on an ocean rowing boat. So firstly, because of the space that's required for a fridge, you know, as you can, I'm sure you can imagine, there's not much space for anything, let alone extra items. But also on the boat, all our power, all our electricity comes from solar. And so that's one thing with ocean rowing that we're told repeatedly by the event organisers, but also other people who've rowed oceans, that, you know, managing your power on the boat can be quite difficult at times already. And so we've had to consider how we're going to manage running a fridge, and a fridge that ideally we need to keep, you know, keep running as well. So we've had to do that. And then with my nebulizers as well, so they have to be charged. So again, it's putting more strain on our power source. But also we've worked with the team and they've helped make sure that the nebulizers are waterproof and are sort of unbreakable, if you like, as well. So hopefully with, you know, and then with the storage of my medication as well, that, you know, hopefully I'll be able to look after my CF as best as possible on the row.
Mm. What can you just talk us through, Janine, what it's 10 metres to me doesn't sound very big for four of you. How is it going to kind of work practically and sleep and things like that?
We're not sure exactly. And one thing I know is that we're not going to be doing at the end what we started doing. Most people work in shifts, so we'll have two people rowing and two sleeping.
It's going to be a balancing act, I imagine. And, you know, you're going to do you get on as a foursome?
Yeah, we do. We're all very different characters, which is kind of enriches the team. So we all have different ways of doing things. We've been working with someone to do team building, which has been invaluable. So understanding each other and understanding how we how risk affects us and how we react to risk, and also understanding ourselves in it. So that's been absolutely invaluable for us.
Sophie, I've got to ask, what about toilet facilities?
So we'll have a bucket. So the facility, it'll be a bucket and chuck it facility. And we always say to people that we'll have two buckets on board. We'll have one which is the toilet and one that will be for washing. So one of the rules is don't get the buckets mixed up.
Oh, gosh. Why have you decided to go at this time of year? Because it seems like, you know, all of us are thinking, I wish the sun would come out, and you're going to go and row on a boat in the ocean. Is this a peak time to go?
So we're rowing from Lanzarote over to Antigua, so the weather is much nicer there than it is here in the UK, in any event. But most importantly, it's outside of hurricane season, and also then we should pick up the trade winds as well. So this is the right time of year for Atlantic crossings.
And Janine, you've done various coaching, haven't you, for other rowers, and I wonder what it is about rowing. I mean, clearly you both must absolutely love rowing because you're going to be doing it for a long time. What is it about rowing for you and the people who you coach that makes you want to do it so much?
I think that there's something about being out on the water, being outside, but out on the water. There's also the rhythm of rowing, I think. A lot of people find it very soothing, and quite a number of people that I have coached have some kind of sort of mental health problem like anxiety or depression, and they find that so, so helpful. It's kind of a mindful thing. And also with rowing, you sit one behind each other, so you don't do face-to-face stuff. So I think some people find that really helpful, and I've seen people's confidence growing enormously. This will be the longest I've ever done, though. I've rowed the Irish Sea three times, but never done an ocean before, so it's going to be really interesting to see how that pans out.
That was Janine and Sophie there, and they left for Lanzarote yesterday and they set off for Antigua on the 23rd of January. Good luck to all four of them who are taking part. Now, author Beth Moran had three children in her 20s, but decided to take up fostering once they flew the nest. Her new book, It Had to Be You, is inspired by her experiences of fostering 13 children in 5 years. She's also a successful author. She's written 12 books, which have sold over 1 million copies globally, and have been translated into 10 languages. Now, she used the money from her books to fund a loft conversion so she and her husband could foster more children. Beth joined Claire this week, and she began by asking her when she had her biological children.
I was 21 when I had my first, when I had my daughter, and 26 when I had my youngest.
Right. So they grew up.
Yes.
They left home. So what made you think, I want to go back to the beginning, I want to do the parenting thing all over again?
We still had one at home when we thought about fostering, but we had two who were in education elsewhere. So, which meant we had a spare bedroom, and we still felt quite young. I was 44 when my youngest turned 18, and we just felt like we had a lot more to give. My husband had run a youth group for 10 years with a lot of vulnerable children there. And although that was very hard work on a Friday night, dealing with a lot of issues going on with 40 teenagers, we used to come home and just think, we could maybe help some of these children. We wouldn't be perfect, but we could maybe be better than what they had. From what
you
we
kind
saw.
Of already, he was already helping them, though, wasn't he? So that's a big step, isn't it, to go from a youth club to having them in your home. and looking after them on a day-to-day basis. Where did you feel there was a gap in the care that they weren't getting?
Well, the fact they used to turn up an hour early and stand outside in the cold because we wouldn't let them in because they would rather be there than at home was a huge thing. And we knew we'd got space. We felt really proud of our children and how they were doing and felt like we've got more to give.
So take us back to the first time and your first experience of fostering. What was it like?
Oh, it was... Our first one was interesting because it was a really challenging situation, to be honest. It was an emergency placement. You just get a call, you get minimum details. They might arrive an hour or two later. So it's really quite nerve-wracking, actually. And that was a short term, just 10 days for that young woman before she moved on somewhere else, which had been the plan all along for her.
And is that very different? You start off there, and that's quite an acute situation to start off in, isn't it?
Yeah.
What happened after that?
So for the first few years, we had a few more medium or short-term teenagers coming to stay with us. Some of them, it was because their parents had asked for them to be taken into care. They were struggling to cope, relationship breakdown. And it was lovely that in those instances, we were able to help repair that family so the children could move back. That was lovely. Others moved on to other family members or elsewhere. And that really suited us, actually, because they'd come for a few months or a year. Then we'd get a holiday, we'd have our empty nester time, which we did really enjoy. Some calm and peace and chance to rest before we started again. But then that did change.
Right, it did change, didn't it? Because you had to make your home bigger.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, we were enjoying it and we felt like this is such worthwhile work. We really love it. We feel like we're doing quite a good job. And we really sat down and thought, is this something that we want to do more? Because we'd only ever had one child at a time. And we knew that, particularly for siblings, to keep brothers and sisters together when they're going through such a difficult situation is a lot to be able to do that. But we didn't have space. My husband had a very busy job as a senior manager for an energy company, and we didn't have time for more than one child. So we really sat down and thought, do we give our all to this? And that was the month that my books really started to sell.
Goodness me.
Yeah. And I had a number one book on Kindle that autumn. So we were already gearing up to have more. We then got a phone call from social services saying we've had four children, brothers and sisters, who've been at the police station all day. There's nowhere for them to go. Could you have one or two? And we just felt like we said, at the time, we didn't even have four bedrooms. We didn't even have four beds. But we said, look, we've got camp beds. If they've literally got nowhere else to go tonight, we would love to keep these children together. And they all came again an hour later, lots of running around making up beds and getting things sorted. It was love at first sight. We just absolutely loved these children. We had 4 days with them, four really wonderful days before, because we didn't have all the bedrooms and various things. They moved them on, they split them up. So my husband went and talked to his boss and said, I'm going part-time. We booked a loft conversion, and as soon as we could, a couple of months later, the older two had been moved into a residential unit, like a children's home. Mm-hmm. So we knew it would be very easy for them to move back if they wanted. They were 14 and 16. So we went and sort of kept nagging social services. Normally foster carers don't ask for teenagers to come back, but we kept saying, we love these children. We would really, really love to have them back. And so eventually they did. And a week later, they moved in and... they're part of our family now.
Did you have all four?
We didn't have all four because the younger two had moved on to foster carers locally, so they were settled there. So they stayed. We would have loved to have had all four, but they're happy and settled where they were with a different foster carer. So it was thought it was best to let them, you know, not disrupt them again to have to come back to us. But what we have been able to do is keep weekly contact. So they have maintained that brother-sister relationship, which is lovely.
That is an incredible commitment. I mean, your book was doing well. Your books were doing well. Yeah. You've got money, so you afford the loft conversion.
Yeah.
And then you bring these children back into your family. What was their response to that?
Honestly, I think particularly for the oldest one, he would say it saved his life. It was everything. You know, I guess there's varying quality in residential units, but the one they were at wasn't the loveliest place. You know, you're not part of a family. You're people who are just paid to come in and do shifts. The turnover of staff is very high. You're with other random children. They've got rules in place that aren't specific to you, but they just knew that the fact that we'd asked for them back, that meant more than anything for them, to be honest. And we have just, it's just worked absolutely brilliantly.
How has it affected your family dynamic with your grown-up children?
Yeah, a lot. It's a big thing. Because I think even when you're in your 20s and you've moved away, you still having your mum and dad is a big thing, isn't it? And it has affected at times both me and my husband being able to help. We've had to be really clear about things like graduations or that we actually need some support so we can both do things like that. It has been something for them to adjust to, but obviously they know these children's stories. You know, they now see them as their brother and sister, and have grown to love them as they get to know them and come home. It has changed things, but it's something we're really aware of and working hard to make sure our adult children still have as much of us as they can.
That was Beth Moran talking to Claire there, and her book, It Had to Be You, is out now. Now, I'm guessing that some of us have already been back working 9 to 5 for the first time since the new year. And the iconic singer of that iconic song, Dolly Parton, is the topic of a new musical. Here You Come Again is currently playing in London before it heads on tour across the UK next month. And joining Claire earlier this week was the star of the show, Tricia Pelluccio. And Claire asked Tricia when she first became fascinated by Dolly.
I first heard the song Here You Come Again on the radio when I was a little girl, and my mom bought me that record. And I listened to that record so many times, and I didn't know any better that you weren't supposed to copy. So I just copied her little grackle and scratch and that kind of vibrato in her voice. And so I've been doing it my whole life. I've been singing like Dolly Parton.
What is it about her? What is it about her voice, first of all?
Oh, I think she's beautiful musicality. I think she really trusts a very soft, beautiful part. She doesn't try to blast out belting. And, you know, when she first came on the scene, people didn't really like her voice because it was so different than that kind of old-fashioned kind of, you know, hearty country sound. She had such a small, delicate voice. But now I think we've all grown to just love it, you know.
She's singular, you know, no one
sounds like her. And she's an incredible lyricist. I mean, that's really what she wants to be known for, is her songwriting. And so as an artist, I think she's created from her heart that is full of inspiration and love and joy. And so she's written these beautiful songs. And that's really her gift. I mean, as much as she is, you know, her gift is her performing and singing. I think it's her songwriting that we really... you know,
she's incredibly philanthropic as well, isn't
yes,
she?
She's
given so much back, but she manages to be apolitical. So why has she chosen that path? Because someone as powerful as her could have said, I'm going to stick my flag on this hill.
I think Dolly's very humble and that she knows that her political opinion, and I'm sure she has one, that the world doesn't need to know that. She doesn't, you know, feel that egotistical need to put it out there. And I think, you know, she's also savvy in that she recognizes that it would really upset half of her audience. And her goal is to make people happy. She doesn't need to be right. So, or make people think the way she does. She's more humble than that.
This feeling of her helping,
yes,
stepping into somebody's life at a moment of need and the music helping somebody.
Yes.
This is the basis for the musical.
Yes.
So tell us the story.
I always thought the best way to create a Dolly Parton musical would be to see Dolly Parton in action. So our show is an envisioning of what we think she would really be like if this situation could become true. The situation is that, you know, there's a man struggling with depression and fear in a very uncertain time of his life in isolation. But he loves Dolly Parton and he has all of, you know, her records and pictures all around. And she comes to life in his time of need.
That was the wonderful Tricia Pelluccio. And Here You Come Again is playing at the Riverside Studios until the 18th of January before heading on tour to Glasgow, York and to Manchester. Now on Monday, Nuala will be back from 10 with a look at the role women in the Church of England are playing in much needed reform of the safeguarding system as the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, officially finishes his duties and steps down. Plus, Mel Gedroych on her brand new game show, Pictionary. That's Monday from 10.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there.
I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.